Well, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about actually is the fact that in this film, there's a lot more dialogue, a lot more interaction, robot on robot kind of thing, which really brings the acting provided by the whole IL team to the forefront. Because, I mean, you know, in previous films, we've had obviously terrific action sequences, but maybe not the same level of dialogue and interaction.
No, when we first got the screenplay and we saw how much the robots were going to be talking into this in this film, it really made us animators excited, because sure, we like to do robots fighting, but anytime you can get them to emote and find some sort of emotion to go along with the exposition of the film is always a great treat for someone creative in an animation role.
You'd previously, as a company, done a pretty advanced animation rig for Optimus Prime anyway, but I'm guessing that you had to revisit the rigging, is that correct?
That's correct. Our pipeline has changed and advanced a little bit, and we were able to take the older asset of Optimus Prime, but then remodel him, not only for a technical reason, but the story point in the movie is that Optimus is in hiding, so he has changed his look, so that that was a great benefit for us, since we had to update the asset anyway, that we took advantage of the story and were able to maintain what we had before, but then update it.
So, as I recall, when we were talking last time and around the time of the last film, there was some discussion around dynamic rigging and the system that you have for doing the animation. Is that something that's been revisited and revised as well?
No, the typical way that us animators work has maintained consistency. You know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But when it comes to technical questions, you know, the fellas that you've talked with earlier would be better at chatting about the rigs than I am. You know, I'm a creative guy rather than a technical guy.
Sure. I guess I was just interested in the control you had on being able to have kind of human-like deformations on what is, after all, a hard metal, hard object kind of face. I mean, it's an inherently very, very difficult problem.
Yeah, what we really liked about Transformers 3 was Sentinel Prime's face, where we had the ability to manipulate the geometry, but it felt like there was an under-rig that was allowing all the pieces to ride on top. So since we thought the look of that worked so well, we decided to incorporate that idea into all of the models here, and we were able to not only blend shapes provided by the actor's performance, but we were also able to grab the geometry itself and shift it, so we had two layers of controls over these faces, since they were so detailed and they were much more robust than any of the robots in the past films.
Yeah, talk to me about Lockdown's face, because that's a new character on screen, and so there's, you know, again, a whole new face. How expressive did you find that, or how much expression did you find you could easily get in that?
Lockdown is about as expressive as you can get these robots to work for us. You know, we used Mark Ryan's face as a heavy anchor on how this face should move on Lockdown. And so using our shapes and using his face as the reference, we got a pretty bang-on match with what the actor provided. And I think that adds a heck of a lot of detail to the performance, because we're pulling up nuances that the actor did, and our controls allowed us to mimic it, very similar to how we did Davy Jones years ago. But this time it's a mechanical face opposed to an organic face.
So on a process like that, are you just going off a camera that's filming their recording of the dialogue, or is there a head cam in addition to that? I mean, what's the reference that the animator is getting of the original performance?
We do ADR recordings whenever the actors are performing, and we can we have a system where we're able to two-dimensional image, we're able to record their face onto the robots. And it is very early in its development, this process, and so we could take the face acting as far as we could with the actor, but then we would have to keyframe on top of that to achieve the perfect goal that we were aiming for.
Yeah, I mean, clearly when you've got a character that is not meant to be a faithful representation of the actor, then there's always going to be a huge amount of creative nuancing added. I mean, I'm sure John Goodman doesn't have a beard like a hound does that's dashing around.
No, he does not. No, I mean, it's a perfect marriage. It's a perfect hybrid situation where we are piggybacking on the performer's performance. You know, we can't, an animator can't come up with every single nuance that an actor can do, and it's just, it's a lot of fun to dissect what they have done with their face and try to mimic it with the tools at our disposal.
While we're still on the faces, and I want to get to some other stuff, but just while we're on the faces, the actual sort of mechanics, as it were, the sort of gearing stuff that's happening, as I understand it, in the past, there'd be like a sort of a really solid level of character animation done, and then some other people would sort of step in and help sort of polish that final bit of gearing, I'm going to call it. But in this film, mm-hmm. that was more responsibility of the same animator, is that correct?
Yeah, we would build a facial performance the way we normally would. In the past, sometimes the geometry would collide in a way that we could not fix it ourselves, and we would share it with another artist whose job it was to what we call create TFM stacks and help maintain the integrity of the geometry. So this time, you know, we're able to do the TFM work ourselves, so we can just take our facial performance from beginning to end without having to hand it off to have somebody else polish up what we couldn't at the time.
So I wonder if we could switch gears to, say, a scene like in Lockdown Ship when the Autobots come mm-hmm. to rescue and break out Optimus Prime. And there is some really good body animation done. And obviously one would tend to focus on when guys are fighting and smashing stuff up. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's also terrific, bots standing around kind of animation that gives them both character and kind of but it's a harder thing to do, right? I mean, it's sort of easy to reference, keyframe art for a power pose or a kind of karate thing, but when you've just got to have people standing around, that's really down to the art of the animator and their kind of nuanced approach. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, animators love to animate. We love to make things move, and in such cases, we will over-animate things. So when it comes to animating characters in the background who are not the focal point of the shot, you want them to still be milling around but not draw the audience's attention from where they should go. And so we need to make sure we keep that animation quiet. And that's really hard, and I'm speaking for myself. You know, as an animator, I want to make things move. So to keep things quiet in motion is one of the hardest things an animator can do, because they have to really push against what they want to do with the background guys.
Yeah, because, I mean, if they're not moving, they're frozen statues. And if they're moving too much, you're like, what the hell's going on back there?
Exactly right. There's that fine line of they're not moving enough and the audience notices them, or they're moving too much and the audience notices them and just blows the flow of the whole scene. And luckily with these characters, they have these robots have more character than the robots in the past movies. And so you'll see that we have their typical poses that they'll strike while they're in the background. You know, Hound is a big, fat guy, and so we've given him a wider stance to support his weight. And Drift is a quieter character, so he has a very quiet personality about him in the background. And a character called Crosshairs, he just never wants to be with the Autobots, but he understands the need to be with them for protection. You know, there's protection in numbers. So his performance, he's always a little bit to the side, and he's a bit more hunched, and he's just so disinterested in what is happening around him that when you do see them in the background, we're hoping that you will feel these personalities coming out of them.
Because just like a real actor, the animator has to, I guess, come up with a backstory on why somebody would do anything. Otherwise, you don't have a sort of a consistent theme for the motions and the actions and the stances they take.
Yeah. Yeah, that is correct. And, you know, when we first started this movie, we have to use temp voice actors because the actors, John Goodman and Ken Watanabe, they hadn't been hired yet. So we still have to create these scenes without the actors, and we do our best, you know, coming up with the personality we think that they're going to have based on what their dialogue is. But I tell you what, once those actors are hired and they provide that extra personality to the robots. It makes our job a lot easier when it comes to trying to pose them, because the voice dictates who these guys are. So when we heard that John Goodman was going to be Hound, which is my favorite character, I was ecstatic because that voice is just perfect.
Yes, he also gives you a really good, well, I mean, in a traditional sense, it would be something to jiggle, but that stomach gives it kind of some interesting motion and sway.
Yeah, and that was something Michael really wanted to do, that this guy, you know, big fat old robot, still has some give in the midsection, and I can relate. Looking at Hound is like looking into a mirror, you know, heavy set guy with a beard. So maybe I'm biased towards that character because, you know, I have some physical relations with him.
So if I can just pose a kind of an odd question, but like let's say Ken, who's playing Drift, you mentioned, that's an Autobot that was a Decepticon. So there's some back character there that, like, it used to be a Decepticon, but there's also the fact that in the alternate display, it's a Bugatti. I'm wondering, does the Bugatti play into the sort of backstory that plays into the animation?
Yeah, what's really great about Drift is he is not only Drift, but the Dinobots as well. These are characters that are going to really play into the Transformers, the Uber fans' wish list. You know, they've always wanted Dinobots, now they've got them, but they've also wanted a triple changer robot, and so Drift turns into the Bugatti, but he also turns into a helicopter. And since movie one, people have wanted a triple changer, and now they've got one.
But I'm wondering, in terms of the performance of him as Drift, like just in terms of how he, you know, these things we're talking about, right? Like these subtle things, how he's standing, mm-hmm. how he acts, where he is in the group, even where he's blocked in a group shot. I'm just wondering, like, does like the Bugatti inherently mean that Drift is faster, cooler, quicker? How much are we sort of like seeing the? I mean, obviously, Hound, I think, is a tactical vehicle kind of thing. Ratchet's like a Hummer. Like, I'm just wondering about those connections.
Well, Drift, since he is a samurai warrior, we didn't play him with the backstory with him being a Decepticon or anything like that. I think that's what the backstory is. But all we wanted to achieve with him was that he is faster than the rest of the robots because of his training in martial arts, and we don't have him using any weaponry other than his sword, so there's an honor to him, and he looks to Optimus as a sensei. I don't know if the backstory is that Optimus has taught him any of these martial art skills that he has, but since he's a beautiful, fast car, we wanted to make sure that he had a beautiful, fast fighting style.
Right. And if we could talk about the Dinobots now, because they are huge fan favorites, also just really interesting in of their own rights. There is, I guess from an animation point of view, a duality. There's clearly the T-Rex in form for, say, Grimlock, but there's also the role that Grimlock plays in relationship to Optimus Prime, which is that of, you know, pretty much like a horse, right? Like a steed, like it's a Western kind of overlay. Could you discuss that?
Sure. I know that Dinobots were a huge fan favorite since I was a kid. I'm one of the few who didn't care too much for Dinobots when I was a kid. And there was a threat of the Dinobots being in the movie earlier, in movie 3 perhaps, and I thought, oh, I don't know if that's going to translate very well into a live-action film. And then I heard the Dinobots were going to be in this movie, and I wouldn't say I was disappointed, but I wasn't sure how we were going to make it work, because, you know, and in reality, transforming into a Dinobot, a big dinosaur, isn't a very good vehicle to hide in. It's not very secretive. And we went down to L.A. To Bay Films, and they pitched us the movie, and they said, at the end of the film, Optimus Prime is going to ride into battle on the back of a mother-effing T-Rex! And I thought, uh-oh, this is going to be really hard to make look cool. The idea of a robot riding a robot is going to be really weird. And then they showed us the artwork, and I was sold. The artwork was super cool. And then Michael looked to us and said, okay, guys, come up with a really cool entrance into a battle for all the Autobots riding the Dinobots. And we came up with Michael with some of the coolest things you could possibly think of to do with these robots, and I'm happy to say that I am now a fan of giant robots running down the streets of Hong Kong bashing bad guys. It was such a pleasure to work on that sequence, and it turned me around, not because, you know, I worked on it and not biased in that way, but some of the stuff that the animators came up with is just so cool, and people, I like to say, people have never seen something like that, which is great for a movie with a number 4 behind it, because something new, something that will bring people back to the theaters again and again, is always an achievement.
Slug is also terrific, right? With the kind of bashing his head kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, each of the dinosaurs, they have their own specialty. You know, Michael really wanted Scorn, he's a Spinosaur, Scorn. He wanted Scorn to jump into battle using his spikes on his back, and so we achieved that, and it looks really cool. He wanted to make sure, you know, I don't want these to look like or act like traditional dinosaurs. I want them to do cool things that a dinosaur couldn't do, so jumping and using your spikes against a wave of bad guys is a lot of fun. And Grimlock, when he launches Optimus Prime into the air so he can fight some guys on a rooftop, Grimlock will jump up like a whale breaching out of the water. Then he'll extract his jaws like a shark to snatch a guy out of the air. You know, this is a lot of fun. It's taking an idea of a dinosaur but incorporating alien technology and a lot of fun fanboy ideas. It's very unique.
Well, while we've gone to the kind of interesting, fun for the animators, fun for the audience category of questions, let me ask you about this. Up on lockdown ship, there's a lot of sort of cells, jails, whatever, that are holding.
Yep.
It's hard to see what's in them. Can you give us a hint as to what's on screen that we can't see until we get a Blu-ray and can park it on some frames?
Well, within the cages, most of them are ambiguous things that maybe we'll see in another future film, but these are all prisoners, and we don't know exactly what they are or why lockdown has captured them. He has been hired by the creators, another being of creatures that we don't see very much in this film, to hunt down Optimus, but for whatever reason, he's got these other prisoners too, and story-wise, to this point, we don't know why.
Okay, so we haven't discussed the KSI characters, and they pose a different animation issue, not which is this kind of almost Terminator 2, we can't kill them, we can't stop them, new tech we've not seen. How did that play into how they were animated?
Well, when it comes to the robots on their own, the personality of the animation is the same as what you had seen before, but when they do transform, it's a very elegant change from car to robot. It's what we called it. It's like a mag tech, if you will, where the pieces fall apart and come back together, and it makes them very difficult to pinpoint where they're going to end up when they transform, because most of the Transformers will transform from robot to car on the spot. But these things can travel a long distance while they're transforming from one form to the other. So there's one character, or I should say three characters, make up one vehicle. It's a big garbage truck. And when this thing transforms, the three guys end up on a second level. So they're not limited to where they are in space. They can travel a longer distance while in the process of transforming. And so when they are in mid-transformation and they turn into a robot, we can hit some pretty cool dynamic poses as their weight and all their pieces come back together. It's a lot of fun for the animators to figure out how to get them to do this sort of elegant dance in the air from the car into a killing robot.
What about how they take a hit? I mean, is there a sort of a sense that they absorb the energy of a hit differently?
Once they are a robot, they are a robot. So they take the hit, and they take it just like another transformer. So they do not, it's not like a T-1000 type situation where a bullet hits them and it passes right through. Once they are that physical form, their build is just the same as, say, Bumblebee's.
And you had some interesting Transformers now that we haven't seen. There's a cape, for example, which is a really interesting animation problem. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, for us animators, the trench coat that Crosshairs is wearing is something we can just easily turn off. You know, we don't animate it with that trench coat on. And then the creature guys, who will then pick up the animation from us, they will simulate that jacket. And I know they went through a lot of different styles of simulation. It was going to be full cloth, but then they decided, well, he's a car. We can't have it be a full cloth cape, so there is an understructure that is metal. So it is simmed in a way that metal would hinge with a layer of fabric on the backside of it. And it makes for a really unique silhouette for Crosshairs whenever he does anything, that he's always has this cape or trench coat blowing in the wind.
That device of a cape or a trench coat, that really can help with producing a dramatic kind of heroic pose, but it's something you haven't had in your arsenal to play with. I mean, it's quite a useful tool, isn't it? Sort of a...
It makes him look cool. The first piece of artwork I saw for the movie was of Crosshairs, and it was him walking with that trench coat, and it instantly, you know who you're looking at. And that goes for all the robots in this movie, that the designs of these robots are instantly recognizable if they are just a simple silhouette. You know exactly who you're looking at. There's no question about it. Where some people in the past films, they have said, well, I don't know what I'm looking at. They all look the same. This one here, their designs are so specific to their personality, and it's just easy to pick out who is doing what. And that's a big benefit when you're watching the battles. You know exactly who is who and who's doing what.
Can we talk about that staging of a battle now? We discussed the more subtle animation. The bigger stuff when you've got a major fight going on, we're no longer talking about sort of character animations in terms of talking.
Yeah.
It's big on, you know, Hong Kong fights. How hard is it to animate in the environment that will presumably not have any of the sims, the destruction stuff happening around them? And, you know, how much does that stuff add and change what you want to do? Because I can imagine I got a character kind of running down and doing something and jumping, but then you put a whole lot of rubble, a whole lot of smoke, a whole lot of other stuff. It's going to change what I can see, how the character looks.
Yeah. Luckily, animation usually drives the action sequences. We started early on with Michael, before even the actors were hired, to start coming up with really cool action situations. And to be honest, this being movie 4, at the end of movie 3, we thought we pretty sure have done everything with these robots. That we're going to have a really tough challenge coming up with new ideas. So we would bash our heads together trying to come up with something we have never seen before. And luckily, since we were so early on in the process, we were given a pretty long time to come up with something that we thought would excite people. And since Michael pretty much knew where he wanted to shoot the action sequences. We had CG environments built of these situations. And so we could stage the actual fight where Michael wanted it, and then he could take that previs on location and continue to evolve the sequence on his own using the location. So that was a big benefit, that he knew where he was going to shoot and what he was going to do. So that was a big help for him.
So for you personally, just in terms of accomplishment of animation rather than sort of any particular plot point, you know, in terms of a scene that really you think delivers a good performance, is there something that stands out that you're really proud of?
Well, this film is so unique in that there's so much acting with the robots and so much action with the robots, and it feels like a new beginning to the franchise, because everything is absolutely new in this movie. Even the look of Optimus and Bumblebee, they look different, and it feels fresh. It's a continuation of what we had seen, but it's fresh, and it was just a lot of fun to be a part of, you know, revisiting, not redoing, but just continuing on, but still being able to make it fresh, and having all the artists on this movie. Everybody has an idea up on the screen, and it's so great to work with Michael because he looks to us to collaborate. He's not telling us what to do, that I want this, I want that. He says, how can we make this cooler? Or we could say, I see what you're doing there, but let's do this so it's more exciting. And, you know, Michael has done something on this film that he hadn't done before, where he had a virtual actor on a stage with him, where he was able to record within that spaceship environment that you cited earlier.
Yep.
You know, he had an actor wearing the pajamas, the mocap suit with the reflective balls, and in front of him he saw Optimus Prime. So he was able to create shots for the first time on the stage with an actor dressed or looking like Optimus, and he was so happy with the process that he looked over at Scott and Benza, the other animation director, and he said, "You know what? I don't think I need you guys anymore."
Oh dear! And that was the first time that had happened on the Transformers films. That's interesting.
Yeah, he had shot CG shots before, but only the environments, and then we put the robots in later. This time we said, you know, we could try this with the guy in the pajamas, and he said, "Oh, I don't know if I want to do that. Having a guy in front of me wearing the pajamas, it might, you know, slow my creativity down. It might be too distracting." We said, "Well, the guy will be in the pajamas. Why don't you just film him? If you don't like it, we can get rid of him, and we can still film the environment and add the robots later." And he said, "Okay, well, who's gonna be your actor?" We said, "Well, we'll use one of our animators." And he says, "Oh, you just blew the dream. Now I know that Optimus Prime is an animator. He's supposed to be a warrior."
So who ended up putting the suit on?
He brought some fight guys down. And that's another thing I should bring up, that since this is movie 4 and we've done it all, this time we used this fellow in the past. His name is Garrett Warren, and he is a fight choreographer, and he brought 4 of his guys down for 2 days. And together down on the motion capture stage, we designed and collaborated to come up with the fights of the movie. And what was unique about these fights is that Lockdown doesn't want to kill Optimus Prime. He wants to capture him since there's a bounty on his head. So we have to come up with fight moves that wouldn't kill. You know, it's not a stick and stab, you're dead fight. It is, you know, I need to maim you. I need to knock you down. I need to disable you. And so it was fun to work with these guys to come up with some pretty brutal fights that will have a different signature than the last fights, because it's not, I'm going to kill you. It's, I'm going to capture you.
Yeah. It's actually a pretty interesting couple of things that you're presented with here. I mean, the Dinobots are a huge thing in their own right. Stuff with the KSI, a huge thing in of its own right. I mean, of course, the dialogue as we started this whole discussion, I think, is probably the most distinctive thing. And I have to say, of those, I would have imagined that the hardest one to pull off is convincing engagement with the audience in a dialogue sequence, because I don't doubt for a second that you could come up with a good fight sequence, even though I get your point. But I would have thought that, I don't know. For me, having characters on screen emotionally delivering more than just sort of, you know, joke responses, but, you know, sort of detailed stuff is really where it's at. And I think you guys did a great job.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun approaching Optimus Prime in this film, because he has a character arc. Usually, you know, he's the big military hero. This time, when we first see him, you know, he's a very vulnerable, betrayed robot. He's broken down, and it's something we've never done with Optimus before, that he doesn't want to save people. You know, the animators got to explore a darker side of Optimus Prime, and Michael even asked Peter Cullen to alter his performance so it sounds more human and less, as you said, Cylon earlier in our conversation.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more. There's a weakness to Prime and an anger. I mean, the first thing he says in this movie is, "I'll kill you." And that's something Optimus would have never said in the past 3 movies. But in this one, you know, we see him in the worst position he's ever been in. And it was fun having to alter him through this film into being the hero that we recognize from the last ones.
Yeah. Actually, while we're on that, it's a point I didn't bring up earlier, but I would like to get your reading on it. I think I was talking to Scott Farrar about it. This in that sequence that you mentioned, you know, in the barn kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in stereo, the point was, well, it's really hard to fit them in the barn space.
Yes.
Because of
Yes.
the poles and stuff. And that mm-hmm. that actually produces a whole lot of extra dimension of difficulty to the animator, because you're trying to get an emotional performance, and this is not a big action sequence at the stage in the barn, but yet, you know, you can't have him lean forward and move through a post that would knock the barn down. And we as the audience are reading this in 3D, so we can't just let you cheat him right, left, and center.
That's correct. Yeah, you've picked up on one of the biggest challenges of a 3D film, where we need to make sure that character is 100% in that 3D space, because, you know, the audience will pick up on it if his arm is going through a post in the back of the barn. It is definitely something that we're constantly faced with, and we come up with a performance on a 2D level, and then when we start worrying about the 3D, then we do need to alter and we do need to adjust things to fit without compromising the performance that we've created. So there is some back and forth once the 3D is being applied to these shots.
So in fact, that's your process. The process is to get a 2D thing down and then see if you can make it work in a three-dimensional space.
Yeah, that's how we've done it all the time. We work in we work on our flat screens. We do have a 3D world to work in, but within the computer, but sometimes that 3D world does not line up 100% with the real world. And so when they start to render things in 3D, they can tell us, whoops, his foot's going right into Mark Wahlberg's face. We need to pull that out of there. So, you know, there is a little bit of back and forth.
Well, again, thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking time to talk us through it, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
It's so interesting at so many levels.
Well, thank you very much. I hope everybody enjoys it.